Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
In this edition of Black's History Week, Professor Jeremy Black talks to The Critic's deputy editor, Graham Stewart, about the Spanish-American War of 1896 and the Russo-Japanese War of 1904-5. Conflicts often interpreted as differentiating rising and declining powers.
We're looking today at two wars, the American War with Spain in 1898 and the war between Russia and Japan in 1904-1905. And each of those wars were important for the combatants, though it's fair to say that all of them have subsequently, and in fact, by 1940, had been supervened by other wars which had a more important role in their public accounts, in their military history, in what people were to recall as narratives of family and community. And there is a degree to which there is always a danger in that consequence that wars get elided out, that they become part of a kind of inconsequential list of conflicts in the past, which have nothing apparently to tell us in an age of drones and hybrid warfare and the present. Well, I think that account is less than accurate. What I would suggest is that it's much more complex than that. I would like to suggest, first of all, there's the nature of place, that if you look at the American-Spanish War of 1898, the two principal places of conflict, Cuba and the Philippines, saw in the case of Cuba an area of conflict, an area of American attempt to expand influence, the defeat of another imperial power, the existing imperial power, Spain, which appears in some respects very pertinent. In the case of the Philippines, the American defeat of the Spaniards was followed by a successful attempt to take control of the archipelago from native peoples. And that entailed, for example, in parts of the Philippines, southern Philippines, a counterinsurgency struggle in which you see an early instance of the 20th century wars of wars across cultural boundaries, in this case, as it were, a theoretically modernizing America and a theoretically backward Islam. So that element appears of consequence today. In the case of the Russo-Japanese War, you have a conflict which overwhelmingly is conducted in the waters off Korea and China, and in Manchuria on land. And again, that appears very pertinent in light of recent and present and possibly future confrontations on the East Asian littoral. So I think it's reasonable to say that there are elements that can appear pertinent. And indeed, one can take that further. One of the reasons, there were others, but one of the reasons why Russia ended the war in 1905 is not just that it had experienced defeats, because of course the vast majority of Russia had not been conquered, Russia had the capacity to go on fighting, but there was an insurrectionary movement within Russia, the so-called 1905 revolution in St. Petersburg, and that in fact, as we know, had been instigated to a considerable extent by Japanese intelligence, just as German intelligence was to play a major role in the Bolshevik uprising of 1917. And again, this is very modern in its feel. Just as it is very modern in its feel that the United States made an effort to align with Cuban nationalists against Spain, successfully so. I mean, the relationship was not without difficulties, but successfully so, but was not able to do so for reasons which, you know, you can argue whether racism played a part in the Philippines. So again, there is a modern feel to it. Now, what else are pertinent in terms of the causes of the conflict? Well, in the case of the United States and Spain, there was both a sense on the part of the Americans, a widespread sense, that they were the rising power. Indeed, they were the most significant industrial power in the world, and Spain was a declining power, and that therefore there was room and need for change, that progress, as it were, would be represented thus, and that Spain anyway was weak in Cuba because it was unable to suppress insurrectionary opposition there. And in addition to that, there was a tension within the United States between a government which was not opposed, or some of its sections were not opposed to see the demise of Spanish power, but which didn't necessarily want the unpredictability of war, and elements of a public opinion, including the so-called yellow press, which were much more bellicose. And I think it's fair to say that the room for manoeuvre of the government was lessened by that bellicosity, rather as with the war in 1812 against Britain and the war with Mexico of 1846. And you might argue that public opinion will also play a significant role in the current and possibly future international crises leading to conflict in current years, even in societies that might appear and indeed might be authoritarian and at the very least anti-democratic. So I think that element occurs. Equally, on the part of Spain, although there was an awareness of an enormous mismatch in power, nevertheless, there were significant elements in the Spanish government, the Spanish military, in the, as it were, colonial interest, in the navy, that did not believe it was right to just surrender the empire, that thought that there was need or cause to fight. And, you know, so often when people talk about the causes of war, and I might refer them to my book, imaginatively called War and Its Causes, so often when they do that, they treat this in terms of rationalization and et cetera, et cetera. But what one might say is the ideology of a group that is, as it were, dominant in government and the military itself is a rational consideration, and anyway is important to its ethos. If you strip away its ethos, then it's only, as it were, an assemblage of units and weapons, and that itself does not give people the esprit de corps to fight. So I think that element is significant. On top of that, as significant, I think you find the same sort of thing on the Russian-Japanese case. In Russia, there were expansionist groups who saw Russia as having a Far Eastern destiny. They had, if you wish to use these terms, rational interests, but also, if you wish to use these terms, irrational interests in terms of, for example, racist views of the Japanese. On the Japanese part, you can see the same. You can see the argument of the how should one put it, the argument of the argument of expansionists who'd already been expansionist in the case of the Sino-Japanese War of 1894-95, who'd already shown a dominant interest in expansion in Korea. And these expansionists saw Russia as a potential opponent, but I think it's fair to say that they did not want a full-scale war against Russia, and I think that's quite important.
Mm-hmm. Well, these are very interesting themes that combine the Spanish-American War and the Russo-Japanese War. I'd like to start, for obvious reasons of chronology, with the Spanish-American War. You spoke a moment ago about Americans having a sense that they were part of a republic on the rise, and Spain was obviously an empire in which was waning. But do we have to go as far back as the Monroe Doctrine in order to describe how America found itself fighting Spain?
No. There had been what are known as filibusters, which were, as it were, semi-private, semi-public individuals and groups who'd sought American expansion in the Caribbean and Central America, and that it included at the expense of Cuba. But Cuba was actually something that was much too big a target. So you get people like Walker, who establishes himself in Nicaragua, for example. But in the case of the 1840s and early 1850s, other powers, to wit Britain and France, had indicated that an American conquest of Cuba or intervention at Cuba would not be welcome to them, and that they would see this as aggressive. So, and there was perceived to be a difference between offshore islands in the Caribbean, many of which, of course, were British or French colonies. There was also, you know, for example, Danish and Dutch and Spanish, and the continental mainland. And the Monroe Doctrine was essentially by non-Americans perceived as referring principally to the mainland. On top of that, the Monroe Doctrine was an aspiration which was quite frankly, you know, the Americans have various pejorative remarks about blowing air and all the rest of it. In the 1820s, the major power in the New World was the British Navy. There was no way that an American state in the 1820s could have dictated to a power like Brazil or Argentina or Chile. And it was actually rather a waste of time. It sounded good. It was a waste of time. By the 1890s, the United States is a very different power and is in a very different situation. And therefore, it is easier for it to think of expansionism. And of course, the opportunities for expansionism are relatively modest. The last rectification of the border with Mexico, the Gadsden Purchase, had been in 1853. In the Caribbean, all the islands belonged to somebody or other, all right? And the only subsequent acquisition the Americans were to make were Guantanamo Bay, obviously, and Puerto Rico, which they got out of the Spanish-American War, and buying the Danish Virgin Islands, which became the American Virgin Islands. Other than that, there's not much opportunity for America. So Spain appears vulnerable. There is a civil war in Spain, all right? And there was a civil war in Cuba, an insurrection, which was weakening Spain. And therefore a sense of opportunity. So I wouldn't say it's to do with the Monroe Doctrine. I would say it's to do more with the new imperialism of the 1880s and 1890s, an imperialism which in the case of America is more directed to the Pacific than the Caribbean, but this is the Caribbean aspect of it.
Can we talk a little bit about what that new imperialism means in an American context? Is it analogous to some might say was the kind of neocon position of the first years of the 21st century, a desire to export what is seen to be an American liberal worldview, particularly in the backyard, as they would see Cuba, and therefore there is a sympathy for the Cuban liberation movement, which then moves into something more concrete? Or is it a genuine desire to build an American empire in the way that European empires would have built an empire?
Well, like everything, and indeed including like the Europeans, because the Europeans in many parts of the world, as we discussed, did not go for formal empire. They went for informal empire. We mentioned that in the case of the British and Latin America, for example. And I would say that element is very much present with the United States and its open door policy in China, where America very much differentiated itself from others in trying to oppose the idea of closed and confined zones that were monopolies for other Western powers and instead wanted an open door policy. Do I see a similarity between neoconservatism, as you put it, in the 2000s and American policy in the late 19th century? Well, America, like all imperial powers of that period, Western imperial powers, and indeed Japan, saw itself as benefiting those it ruled. So if you want it from that point of view, there is a similarity. But the last thing neoconservatives wanted to do was to create a new empire in which Americans were having to pick up the cost and burden of running parts of the world. And indeed, one of the things that is very silly about a lot of the modern critique of classical Western imperialism is the failure to note its high cost. I mean, in many senses, you're better off not running colonies, not running, not being a major empire, having naval bases, having a powerful navy to protect trade, but not then having the protection cost of running, you know, societies on land. And of course, you know, that doesn't fit in with classic Marxist critiques of imperialism, but quite frankly, they're pretty stupid.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, the big event that brings war on formally is the explosion on the USS Maine, which is, you know, seemingly still a historical mystery more than 120 years on. But without that, do you sense that the level of American involvement in Cuba was leading, nothing is inevitable in history as we know, but seemed to be leading inexorably towards open conflict with Spain? Or should we really see the explosion on the Maine, caused by whatever means, as something which fundamentally changed the situation and made war almost inevitable?
Well, nothing is inevitable. I mean, by the way, the explosion was probably a boiler explosion. I mean, by the very nature of things, the boilers being used in that period were prone to accident. So the very presence of the USS Maine in the waters where it was scarcely the act of a state that was not already taking part in actions which you might or might not regard as bellicose and at least tending to problems. So, no, I think probably, and I think the same thing is true of the Second Boer War, which we talked about last time, and is true of the Russo-Japanese War. Probably there would have been war, but it's worth pointing out, and as you know, I've written quite extensively on the causes of war, that many scenarios that might lead to war do not necessarily cause war to arise. And in fact, that very year, as you know, there was a major instance of that. What's the answer to that one, Graham?
In 1898, for Fashoda.
Well done. So in other words, Britain and France come near to conflict, fleets are deployed in position, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and there isn't war. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to have war just because you move into certain circumstances, and other things can supervene. But I think it's fair to say that from the perspective of Spain in 1898, there is the problem that America does not seem to be having a confrontation with any other power.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So apart from obviously the American Civil War itself, how battle ready are American troops? I mean, the Civil War's a long time ago by 1898. What kind of preparations they have?
They're not. The American army is not particularly battle-worthy. What gives it its great advantage in the Cuba crisis is the destruction of the Spanish Navy that is there. And what that does is isolate the Spanish troops and give the Americans the opportunity to be deployed as wish. Once landed, they don't find it a walkover. In the case of the Philippines, again, the decisive battle is the Battle of Manila Bay. It's the naval battle. Spanish forces do not collapse in Cuba. I've actually been to Santiago, where there was fighting, as you know, outside the naval battle offshore, and also, obviously, fightings from the American troops once landed. And I think one could fairly say that it was, and this is a theme we've discussed in the case of the British Army and a number of its wars, it's the kind of conflict in which you start off and you don't do as well as you might have done in a year's time. But luckily for America, and indeed luckily for Japan in a very different war, the dramatic nature of the naval victory is what dominates attention and provides a dynamic of success and a narrative of success, which helps to determine governmental opinion and international opinion.
Well, we'll come to Japan very shortly, but I wonder if you could sketch, maybe particularly for a British audience that doesn't know a huge amount about the Spanish-American War. I wonder if you can maybe just sketch a little bit more about the nature of this 16-week campaign, and not just for Cuba, but how it is that the cause célèbre of Cuba ended up with the American Navy and landings in the Philippines as well, you know, a totally different ocean.
Well, Spain's major overseas possessions were Puerto Rico and Cuba in the Caribbean, both of which were invaded, the Philippines, the Carolinas, and the Marianas in the Pacific, and the Philippines are invaded, and Ifni and Tangier in Morocco, which is not attacked. Okay. Now, in the case of Santiago, the Spanish warships, they had four modern cruisers and two destroyers. And I mean, I can remember going to the point is that it's a relatively narrow passage to the sea from the anchorage. Incidentally, if you may recall, the latest James Bond film has an episode theoretically in Santiago. And as the Spanish warships came out, they came out individually and were then engaged at a distance by American gunfire, and they weren't really in a position to provide mutual support. So the American warships, which were not brilliantly commanded, had actually sitting duck targets. That is the key element. Now, in the case of Manila Bay, the American squadron, which was recognizably stronger than the Spanish squadron, which were essentially coastal gunboats. And the Americans, they sailed in, they, you know, destroyed the Spanish fleet, they silenced the coastal batteries, and that was that. Dewey was then in a difficult position, didn't have any troops with him. I mean, Dewey is the commander of the American squadron, didn't have any troops with him. So he couldn't actually capture Manila. Interestingly enough, what the battles showed was the difficulty of using new technology. So only a minority of the American shells actually found their targets. I mean, you're not talking about the sophistication of the Japanese Navy when it's slugging it out with the Russians in 1904, 1905. And you're not talking about fleets of that scale. But nevertheless, and nor are you talking about American fleet that's to be as big or strong as the one that Teddy Roosevelt is to develop and send around the world, the so-called Great White Fleet. But the naval battles are complete. Spain's Cuba squadron's gone. Spain's Far Eastern squadron has gone. What that does is give the Americans the opportunity to operate at will against coastal targets. Now, you could say that what the Spaniards could have done, if they, you know, is just, as it were, retreat into the interior of Cuba and said to the Americans, well, sod off, you know, you know that kind of position. You know, but of course, Spain is not going to be fighting a guerrilla war. Spanish authority is very much concentrated in the cities of Cuba. The cities of Cuba, as you may know, are all on the coast. They are all subject to coastal bombardment. In fact, there was also an American landing on the north coast of Cuba and an American landing in Puerto Rico. And, you know, with any colonial society, they are dependent on links back to the metropole, or not completely dependent, but heavily dependent. And what that means is you break the links with the metropole and people start to think, well, you know, when and how are we getting out of this? So, I mean, I don't think there's much more to say about the Spanish-American War, apart from the very sensible decision the Americans made, which was analogous to the decision they made in the Mexican-American War. In the Mexican-American War, the United States annexed primarily areas of Mexico, because they were parts of Mexico, let's remember this, where the number of Mexican settlers were modest, and where in some cases, California, there were a lot of Anglo settlers. Ideas were strongly advanced that they should annex territory further south, which included territory they'd occupied, conquered, whatever term you wish to use, and they chose not to. That was very wise of them. It meant that there was a relatively easy closure from the war. In the case of Cuba, exactly the same. The Americans install a government which, quite frankly, is an allied government which allows American financial interests to spread. Spanish interests had controlled much of the economy. The Spanish currency there collapses. The Americans buy up a lot of the assets cheaply, sugar production, for example. Cuba becomes an informal American colony, economically so, plus with the military base, the Americans can use it at Guantanamo Bay, plus obviously Cuba is not going to follow an independent foreign policy that's anti-American, but without the Americans having the problem of having to run it.
Mm-hmm.
They're very wise.
And looking at the consequences in the Pacific, the victory in the Philippines for America, is that a decisive moment in which America develops a Pacific strategy, develops navies, Guam as well coming in and so on, and therefore we see this as a precursor to what the Pacific theater of the Second World War involved?
Well, I mean, America had already been a Pacific power from the mid 19th century. Indeed, in some respects, Willis's voyage from before that. I would say the opening up of Japan, which we talked about in an earlier program in the early 1850s, is a good example of America already deploying force in the Western Pacific. And indeed, there had been landings of American Marines in places like Guangzhou to protect American interests. And America was already pursuing interests in Hawaii and the Samoan Islands. So I would say America was already a Pacific power. I would say the Philippines added a significant new dimension to it. And indeed, it was taken further by something we haven't yet mentioned, which is the linkage provided by the Panama Canal. And Panama obviously is detached from Colombia in 1903 and then cedes the Panama Canal zone to the United States. And that again is a powerful affirmation of America as a two-ocean power. So the Philippines is a stage in that, but not the cause of it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's stay in Asia-Pacific now and move to the Russo-Japanese War. People talk about the Meiji Restoration of 1868 and the beginning of a modern Japan. What is really meant by that?
Well, can I just actually say one linkage between the two points is not just the Pacific, it is America is called in the end to mediate the Russo-Japanese War, which itself is a very interesting and significant development of American prestige in that era. Right. Do we really want a course on the history of Japan? I think we have to be careful here, not least because the narrative of the Meiji Restoration leading to modernization and equating with modernity is one that is sometimes propagated more actively than possibly it should be, because it leaves out the counterfactuals of what else would have happened. But leaving that aside, there is a more assertive Japan in policy terms linked to an industrializing Japan, which borrows significant effects and ideas from the West at the same time as that it's taking part in a parallel with what the Chinese attempt, which is known as the self-strengthening movement. So I think one has to be cautious of necessarily buying into absolutely everything that's said about the Meiji Restoration, but it is significant. There's no two ways about it. And it also reflects a powerful individual, just as another state which developed quite appreciably, which we've already mentioned, a comparison the Japanese might not necessarily be comfortable with, Menelik II and Abyssinia, Ethiopia, that again saw the strengthening of Abyssinia very much around an elite that looked to a particularly powerful military figure.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So What is the causus belli between Imperial Russia and Imperial Japan?
Oh, control over essentially the East Asian littoral. I mean, not to make too fine a point about it, you've got two powers expanding in the area. We've already mentioned that the Russians took over the Amur Valley in 1858, established Vladivostok in 1860, projected their power themselves into Manchuria and Sakhalin. The Japanese are doing exactly the same in exactly the same areas. So it's power competition. Both of them, if you like, competing over a weakening Japan, sorry, a weakening China. Although I think it's more complicated than that, to put it mildly. And I don't think it's just moving into a vacuum. That's an insult to the Chinese of the period and indeed to the Koreans. But the escalation in 1904, which incidentally would probably have not occurred if Russia had been otherwise engaged. So in a sense, there is a sort of conflict by opportunity that plays a role in this. This escalation leads to both significant naval conflict, indeed the largest battle of the war of the age of battleships, you know, plus very large-scale conflict on land. I mean, the scale of the conflict in terms of the numbers available is completely different from the Boer War or the Spanish-American War. Of the 20 years prior to World War I, the outbreak of World War I in 1914, in which both Russia and Japan are incidentally on the same side. But in the 20 years prior to that, it is the most large-scale war, and therefore the war that commentators to a degree look at.
Mm-hmm. So how does the Russo-Japanese War develop on both on land and on sea?
Well, which one should we do first? Let's do sea first, shall we? Because I've always interested in sea. You've got the Japan has built up a powerful navy, British expertise, and British warships to a considerable extent, or warship models, I should say, and it's big guns, I mean, 12-inch guns. So, you know, firing very long distance. There are two key battles, the Battle of the Yellow Sea, number one in 1904, and then the Battle of Tsushima in 1905. Now, the background to that latter one is the main Russian fleet, which was based at Kronstadt, outside St. Petersburg on the Gulf of Finland, and sailed all the way around, including having a row with British fishermen on Dogger Bank, who they'd taken to be Japanese torpedo boats. I mean, you know, you couldn't make it up, could you? Sorry, I shouldn't say that. Real people were put in, you know, but I mean, it really is extraordinary if you think about it. So they sail around. All the Russian battleships are sunk or taken, 10 of them. Japan only loses three torpedo boats. The Japanese ships are newer, larger, better commanded, and they take and use both the operational and the tactical advantage. And I think it's fair to say that this is the key element that, you know, causes Russia to lose confidence. I mean, on top of that, when Port Arthur falls, which is the major Russian base in what is now China, there's another four Russian battleships sunk by Japanese gunfire. So Japan has really worked out in what is the Mahanian idea after the American theorist Alfred Mahan, the idea that war would be determined by battleships, which of course was certainly to be true of that naval war. It was true that in World War I, the overwhelming battleship numbers of the Allies was a key element. But I think it's fair to say that by World War II, you have a different configuration. And already in World War I, you'd had the usage of submarines. And submarine technology is available in the Russo-Japanese War, but it is not a submarine war.
Mm-hmm. And the war on land?
Oh, well, the war on land sees big battles. The most famous is Mukden. It sees machine guns, searchlights, barbed wire, rapid firing artillery. It doesn't see poison gas, but it see or aircraft, but it sees basically everything you're going to see on the Western Front. And the lesson learnt from it, if you wish to use that term, is one that's not pertinent, as it turns out, or maybe it is pertinent. The power that attacks wins. That's the lesson that is learnt. The Japanese attack, they take heavy casualties, they beat the Russians, Russia loses. What you have to do in World War I is to attack. The problem is that underplays the complexity of the war. The Japanese are able to defeat Russian forces, but they can't force surrender on the Russians. And the Russians, in withdrawing deeper into Manchuria, are putting an enormous strain on Japanese war economy. I think what is more significant in the end is the sense of failure that stems from the naval battle, which we've talked about, and from political difficulties within Russia. I mean, that's what I would say, but, you know, to give you an idea, the Battle of Mukden in February 1905, each side deployed about 300,000 troops along a nearly 50-mile front. They used trench warfare. You know, it was heavy casualties. The Russians, it's worth bearing in mind, were actually in the zone of conflict, Manchuria. They were locally outnumbered and poorly supplied, depending on a very precarious Trans-Siberian railway link. But what actually was the case is that Russia, whilst it was economically more powerful than Japan, was fighting at really the limits of its power, which I think was you know, very, very difficult. And again, I think it's fair to say that the Russian commanders didn't show the killer instinct of their Japanese counterparts.
Mm-hmm. There's a sense that morale is much higher on the Japanese side. The soldiers are fighting with more zeal. Was morale poor on the Russian sides, or was it really just a matter of better soldiery and better generalship and better supply on the side of the Japanese? And
what I'm always wary of is to give a unitary answer. Sure. So, I mean, I think that the logistical strain was important for the Russians. The fact that Japan was fighting nearer its base area is significant. But clearly, and of course, the Japanese liked to believe that willpower was the key element. And that was, of course, a lesson that a lot of people wished to learn from the point of view of World War I. It only takes you so far, willpower. I mean, so fighting determination is key. But both sides actually did show a considerable amount of resilience. We don't know what would have happened if the war had gone on, which I think is a pertinent point. The Japanese outfought the Russians in a form of war in which both sides were able to benefit from advanced modern technology. Both were trying to get used to advanced modern technology. For example, the machine gun. Outside commentators were not terribly impressed by the way either power used the machine gun. I think that the Russian commander-in-chief was not up to it. But I think we are too often, as we so often do in military history, arguing back from results to necessary causes. Mm. And I'm always a bit wary of that.
Mm. So, I mean, we have on land many of the aspects we associate with the First World War: trenches, machine guns,
searchlight, field telephones, artillery firing from concealed positions, a lot of that, but also mass troops massing forward.
Yes.
Rather than the kind of much more sophisticated attacking techniques that it would be used increasingly by the British and to a great degree the French and to a degree the Germans in the latter stages of World War I.
The Germans, British and French high command, how well were they schooled in the Russia-Japanese War, and did they learn the wrong lessons from that knowledge?
Well, it's always difficult to learn to determine what are the right lessons. I mean, but let's say, first of all, they had military missions with both sides. Some of my books I've cited from the stuff from the British military mission. What did they learn? They learnt that the next war was likely to have a high casualty rate, which was correct. They therefore assumed it would be a quick war because they assumed it would be difficult to sustain that rate of casualty. Well, they were wrong on that. They assumed that the power that attacked would ultimately win. Well, you could argue that that's what happened in 1918. But on the other hand, the Germans had quite a few attacks in the meantime. They probably, as is normal for the militaries, underplayed the political dimension of strategy. But that's perfectly normal with military matters. On the naval side, I think they took from Tsushima the Trafalgar lesson, that there would be a major naval battle, it would be a cataclysmic battleship engagement, and it would help to determine success. Well, yes and no, Jutland wasn't that battle. Although looked at more profoundly, it did help to determine British success because it, you know, led to the German disengagement from battleship warfare to a significant extent, and in fact their decision to embark on a submarine warfare that helped to bring America into the war. Mm-hmm. But certainly you did not have the great battleship engagement that had been anticipated. Remember, when people talk about learning lessons, you have to always think about how lessons are mediated through the existing power structures, doctrines, strategic culture of particular militaries.
Mm-hmm. The war ends with President Teddy Roosevelt offering to mediate, and there's the Treaty of Portsmouth in New Hampshire, not the English Portsmouth. Why did America get diplomatically involved, and for what end?
Yes, it's interesting you mentioned that Portsmouth in Britain is actually founded by immigrants from New Hampshire. That's not generally known, but that's an interesting point. Sorry, a joke. Okay. I have the benefit of being able to see my interlocutor. Why? Well, America had a number of... First of all, it wanted to try and bring the war to an end. America had this, as it were, sort of PC approach to things in that period. But you see, Britain couldn't, because Britain was a traditional ally of Japan. France couldn't, because France was allied to Russia. Who was going to do it? The United States is a Pacific power, which was seen as a relatively clean pair of hands. Certainly saw itself in that light. And you do need some kind of, well, you don't need to, but it was helpful to have somebody to suggest some ideas. I mean, in practical terms, the Japanese were not going to allow what had happened in 1895, when, having beaten the Chinese in the Sino-Japanese War, or the first Sino-Japanese War, well, actually it wasn't the first, there was one in the 13th century, but anyway, you know where I'm coming from. When having beaten them, they felt that they had been denied the gains they should have had by international mediation or intervention. And they felt that had been wrong in 1895. So that encourages them to look for what they see as an honest partner in 1905.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll have to leave it there. But Professor Jeremy Black, for talking through the Spanish-American War and the Russo-Japanese War, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.